It's Tuesday, November 1st, 2011, and you're listening to episode 249 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 1 minute.
Hello, and welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Pat.
This is Johan.
This is Wayne.
This is John.
And where's Dan?
Oh, I don't know. Taking a crap.
I don't know where he is.
About an hour and a half.
I honestly don't know where he is. Don't know what happened to him. I'm not drunk with power from being in charge now.
What's with all that duct tape?
Never mind the blood stains on the carpet behind here.
Since Dan isn't here, can we offend all of our female listeners?
Oh, I try to do that as often as I can anyway.
Female listeners, please look at a picture of Pat. You are now offended.
Nice.
I know I am.
Without Dan here, who do you think is going to edit this podcast? It's going to be offensive. So to get this show rolling, we were talking about some very highbrow intellectual topics at dinner.
Chief among them was, decided that they were dumb.
So instead of that crap, we're going to talk about the hottest chick on Star Trek.
That's not a neckbeard conversation at all, 7 of 9.
So you say 7 of 9 is your favorite.
That's right. I think subtlety is overrated.
Now, I think to Paul,
long hair and curvaceous assets, by which I mean boobs and butts, and work very well.
I will agree with you that at the time that 7 of 9 debuted, I think it was the height of Jeri Ryan's beauty. Not to say that she's gone downhill, but as she's aged, I don't think she looks as good as she did in Silver Suit.
She probably debuted at 30 in
but I guess
show,
that's irrelevant. You can say that about anybody.
40s, so yeah,
so yes, in the
cares?
Prime is good. But I would say I think my favorite is going to be Jadzia Dax.
And you would be right. So there you go. End of discussion. We're right. They're wrong.
Hey, Wayne, you still get a vote?
No, he
voted to Paul.
To Paul.
Okay, you did.
Very strong candidate. Very strong.
Very strong candidate.
I think actually, as far as sexualization, I think to Paul wins hands down because they were more
both
overtly,
of your hands down.
Yes, hands down, and you know,
every episode something would have to happen for them to have to go through detox. Because detox involved rubbing her down with some sort of gel.
Went to that well so often, and no other series was so overtly sexualized as what they were with DePaul, and God bless them for it.
DS9 had a lot of romantic subplots that wove in and out of even multiple seasons. Mm-hmm. And they never put anything on the camera, but they had plot points around Odo walking down to Kira's chamber and being told to go away because she's banging a Vedic. Like, that happened.
Yeah,
that's true. Know, who hasn't?
But,
who hasn't walked up to the girl they were trying to get with and Vedic Barile is in there wailing away on her? Damn you, Vedic Barile.
Gotta hate that.
We've already talked about this kind of thing before. If I were in the Star Trek world, I would be more like Ensign Barkley. Whoever I wanted would be in the holodeck.
Oh, hell yeah.
You're set.
Are you kidding? I would be like Barkley in the fact that basically one of the first episodes he was in was that he was addicted to the holodeck. Hell yeah.
I don't know how the entire freaking Star Trek world isn't addicted to the holodeck. We're addicted to World of Warcraft, and World of Warcraft can't suck our...
Exactly.
You know, I always thought there must be something in the programming that keeps it from getting to that level. But once you get to Deep Space Nine, you have the Holo Suites, where that's the purpose of
them. The whole business Quark runs is selling you VR sex. And if you can somehow get like a sim profile of, I don't know, another person on the station that you have a crush on, there are entire episodes devoted to him screwing around at programs and himself getting double-crossed with like... Load Kira in there. I want to bang her. And what does Kira think about this?
That would so be my profession in the future. I would be Quark.
The digital pimp.
That is awesome. Yeah.
Quark covers all bases, man. He's got the Dabo tables. He's got 9,000 cases of Kanar that he'll sell you for like a Starfleet penny.
Not to mention Yamak sauce.
Yeah, he was set, man.
I have no idea what it is, but he always has it.
Okay. So,
and it sells, man. If it's good, it sells.
Whatever I'll bring in the gold press platinum.
Now, here's another one, because we touched on this with the Dax issue. So you had Jadzia, and then when eventually Jadzia unfortunately died, we were replaced with...
Ezri.
With Ezri Dax.
Jadzia dies.
The Jadzia host...
I'm on season 3, Pat.
Okay, guys, spoiler from 1996. it. When there's a new character named Dex, and it's a character that is Johan. A serial parasite that goes from host to host, that one died.
Oh,
she lives on in Ezri, kind of.
In Ezri. And that brought up another debate of, well, see, here's the thing. I thought that Ezri was very attractive and a very cute girl, but that's the distinction. I find her, she's more of the girl next door type, cute, bubbly, pixie type girl. Very attractive. I thought she was very pretty, but I preferred Jadzia because she was more sultry and, you know, more sexual and more sexy and seductive.
I think they cast her exactly for that reason. They still made her appealing, but they made her as unlike Jadzia, Terry Farrell, as they possibly could.
And I fall on the other side of that from you, Pat. For me, I will take the cute over the sultry every time. I think the cute is far more attractive. The sultry is just in your face and doesn't do it for me.
I've had a better end result historically with cute chicks than sultry ones, but that's probably pretty common because there tend to be personality correlations between the two various archetypes. And
yeah, that's we can leave it at that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Now, as far as the women of Star Trek go, I think we're all missing out on a key point here.
Captain Janeway.
Loxana Troi.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, true.
I met her in person at a convention once, and she's actually much more beautiful in person than as the horrible hair freaking character that she played.
I was actually shocked when I looked her up on IMDb and realized how old the actress was.
Oh, really?
When she was in TNG.
Really?
What was she in her
30s? Very attractive. She was in her 50s.
No freaking way.
Not on TNG.
I pegged her ass as like 31.
Pretty sure.
No.
Because my wife and I were both shocked.
Wow. I would give you that she was in her mid-late 30s, but there's no way she was 50 in the TV series. Unless she's like...
Not Deanna. She's Loxana. Mom.
Oh, good Lord.
Okay, I was thinking
Hold
Deanna.
On. Back yes, up. Time yes, out. Yes, 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 yes. Time out. Wait a minute.
You guys missed my joke. But
okay, so the joke is it was an okay.
Yeah, I'm just sitting here. At first when you said it, I'm like, really? But then they're all bored with it. I'm like... Man, I must be the odd one out here.
No, you're not.
I mean,
no.
I know John likes cougars,
we're showing our Star Trek.
I go into the 30-year-olds know what they're doing more than fellow students, not the geriatral file.
Yeah.
Venturing into Johan's awkward confession territory here. But one of the first Photoshop celebrity porns I ever saw was downloaded off of BBS, a GIF of... The actress that plays Loxana Troi, I forget her name, but her head on a naked body. Nice. And I was looking at it on a 16-color monitor. Going,
God, I remember when bringing a porno print out to school was like...
That probably took you like 10 minutes to download that one picture.
Oh, yeah, because you managed to download it and print it without getting caught, and it took you a long time.
Yeah, we're talking 10, 15 minutes, a half hour for one picture.
Yeah.
Then while you're watching it load, it's like, Light. Almost nipples. See, there!
We're old enough that we actually know what UU encoding means.
Oh, yeah.
Kids these days, good Lord. They're like, what?
Yeah.
Huh?
My idea of the prototype of the internet was like 28.8 AOL. Yes, very slow. No, not line.
I was tooling around.
I downloaded that picture on 2400 baud, baby. Ooh,
I was tooling around work in one of the labs the other day, and I actually came across a box of old computer shit, and in it was a 14.4 modem. And it was actually a model that I had. I'm like, I remember this from 20 years ago.
Yep, I started BBS.
I remember shelling out $100 for that upgrade.
Yeah, no kidding.
I remember buying it at 56K for $100 and thinking it was a deal.
Craziness.
So. In conclusion, we've all picked our Star Trek women. We are now the gooniest goons in the history of the internet.
Star Trek really doesn't. I say Star Trek doesn't hold up to a lot of sci-fis when it comes to that, though. When I think Star Trek, I don't think hot chicks, with the exception of T'Pol and Seven of Nine and things like that. Versus, say, comparing it to Buffy, where the lineup is just, you know, huge.
Elijah Dushku,
Allison Hannigan. Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Only reason I got into How I Met Your Mother for what brief time I did.
Allison
Freaking
Hannon?
Hell, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Rock on, dude. Yeah, because Wayne and I were talking about that before we started. I love redheads, and Allison Hannon is one of my favorite.
Yeah, she's hot.
She is hot.
One of the hottest people on any show that I've ever watched was on Angel. Whoever the actress is that plays Winifred, the character Fred, she was just so shy
and
awkward and cute. And,
and like you said, she's one of the ones that was able to pull off both sides of the coin, because when she was Fred, she was that sort of cute girl next door, shy type that you like.
Yep.
I hated what they did to the character. But when she becomes Illyria, oh, the spoiler alert again.
What happens Sorry, to Fred, Johan, Pat?
But let's just say when she goes through a metamorphosis, she definitely becomes the badass, not even sexy. She's just a badass. But she's definitely playing that hardcore, more sexy character overtly.
So. And I thought she was absolutely and totally not as sexy after the change.
Yes.
She was so much hotter as Fred.
Same here. She hit everything for me when she was Fred. The shyness, the awkwardness, the cuteness.
The guy name.
The long hair.
So, okay. So along that vein, who's the hottest chick on Firefly?
Kaylee.
Exactly. Yeah, that is the only right answer. Moving along.
That's not even a debate.
Yeah.
And the ironic part of that is that the actress who played Kaylee, when she got the part, they made her put on 15 pounds.
Did they really?
Play the part. Mm-hmm. She said that was her favorite part that she ever played because it was just cheeseburger after cheeseburger.
Yeah, I've seen her in some of the other pictures, the older before that, and she looks much better being a little bit bigger than she was in her older pictures. For me, the second one isn't even Inara. It's River easily takes second.
Not me. River's freaky.
No.
Really?
I'll give it to Inara.
I like Inara.
I think Inara resonates with our crew because she's like paid to bang virgins.
No, that's true. I like that actress with long hair. I don't like her look that she took on for V. And again, I'm bad and I don't know the actress's name, but I can't remember it.
Later. There's something that always appeals to me about a really crazy character, which is one of the reasons I like River.
See, she's the Joss Whedon mono 15-year-old girl with super magic.
Yeah, like, she was Buffy with black hair.
It is an interesting exploration of archetypes of gender and age and puberty and blah, 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 blah. Oh my God, you could not find a setting where he won't work it in there. You could do March of the Penguins and a penguin would be a 15-year-old girl with telekinetic kung fu. I'm tired of it.
I liked her in other shows where she aged a little bit better. I think that she was just maybe a touch too young.
Yeah,
in
she was very young, very like starved looking.
Yeah.
She did a very good job of coming off as like beastly in that sort of feral, savage, cornered rat kind of way, but she did a little too well for me to think of her sexually.
Particularly, though, in Serenity, in the movie versus the TV show, I thought it came out a lot better.
Well, yeah, she was a little older and a little better fed by the time of the plot of Serenity.
And Kaylee was skinnier, and so she didn't have as good a competition.
True.
And we saw Simon's butt. We didn't see Kaylee's butt. Thanks, Josh Whedon, you bastard. I do that on purpose.
That's funny. Oh my God, the people are going to piss off.
Oh, I know.
That's John at Fear the Boot.
Yeah.
Oh, since you're talking Firefly, I can't remember the character's name because they changed it a bunch of times. But from the episode, Mrs. Reynolds.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Saffron. Yes.
A.K.A. Joan. A.K.A.
That is an actress that covered both halves. In that episode, she was the
and little cute, else.
The sweet. You know, she had that all down. But she also had what you're looking for in the character, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Christina Hendricks has gone a long way to bring shapely women back into vogue versus very, very thin women.
That's a trend I would like to see continue. Very good. All right, well, I think we've beaten this one to death.
We'll certainly be beating something later off the mic.
So let's move on to something more game-related, shall we?
All right, if you're going to insist on game-related topics. While I was on my lengthy commute up here, I've been listening to the Wheel of Time series on audiobook, and it occurred to me that there is a very fundamental difference between how that series portrays the world versus how Lord of the Rings portrays its world. In the Lord of the Rings, the setting is very much a downward trend of power. Everything used to be wonderful, and now it's all going away into mundanity.
It's turning from fantasy into reality.
Whereas in the Wheel of Time, everything is going from not exactly mundanity, but from a lesser to a more and more powerful environment. And it occurred to me that everyone thinks of role-playing games as following the path of Tolkien. Every fantasy RPG is Tolkien-based. I make the finger quotes.
Yes.
But
very adeptly.
I realize that it's not at all true. Every fantasy role-playing game I've ever played in has followed the upward trend, which is exactly not what Tolkien did.
Imagine a D&D world. All the level 20 wizards and fighters gather together. They find a level 1 commoner hobbit and say, well, we have to give the bomb to him because he's weak and humble and he won't be tempted to use it against us. Go march off into the gates of death.
Also, we're going to sail across the ocean and go live on a nice island.
Yeah, and also, screw off. We're done. we're going away, have fun. I mean, that actually does happen. Abandonment by the old allies is a classic trope and way of upping the stakes. But the D&D world,
what will almost always happen is that level one character that the burden is given to becomes the level 20.
Yes, exactly. And he can't do that in Tolkien. In fact, it only gets worse as time goes on. He loses his allies. He eventually succumbs. And it's only because other forces who are themselves addicts and losers fight him for it that the ring
gets destroyed.
And then
one day he finds himself driving over to a friend's house to record a podcast about RPGs in a room.
That's right. That is the ultimate end of the hero's journey. It's not the Grey Havens. It's not banging Rosie Cotton. It's being a Fear the Boot host. We all have our place on the ships, my friends. We are the bearers of the internet.
And what you're talking about and the fact that all the role-playing games or the certainly the fantasy genre games are based on Tolkien, I think they're based on the elements within the Tolkien universe, not so much the path, yes, the downward path of them.
They're based on the superficial trappings of the Tolkien, right, universe, but absolutely 180 degrees away from,
right,
the core narrative.
I mean, I absolutely agree with you. I can't think, and I know someone's going to, and they're going to mention it.
Fight him about this on the forums.
I can't think of a fantasy, you know, role-playing game that has that tending toward mundane.
Okay, I'm not fighting the indie game guy, you know, that shows up and has that
path. But absolutely, I think that Tolkien is the grandfather of modern fantasy because he was one of the first. You know,
the first modern.
The first modern. There, right, were other, you know, the ones that have come since then. Yeah. It's just
the ones before him were like the guy who wrote Beowulf.
They're building on the shoulders of Tolkien.
Arthur. Yeah,
and C.S. Lewis, and you know those, you know, some of those other people. That,
the way I always saw it is, it's
Lewis
not
and Tolkien art. Yeah, they hung well, out together, it's not, but they're not.
Yeah, the way I always saw it is they're not taking it from the perspective of like the Lord of the Rings time frame. It's just the world that was existed before. More similarities to the Silmarillion than there is to Lord of the Rings. There were tropes that were brought to the forefront then. I don't really even want to say that they were created there. I mean, he popularized a lot of it, but I don't know how much was actually original in his world creation.
I think possibly one of the unique things that he did was that tending toward the mundane, because the whole point is that you're talking about basically past Earth, where it had all this power and the magic and the splendor and the grandeur. The whole point was that we are passing into a new age, and the new age that's coming is going to essentially be modern Earth with no magic. Yep. No,
that is so common now in fantasy storytelling. But you're right, I've never seen it in a game.
Yeah.
Do you think you could run a, say, D&D campaign that keeps to those tropes and trends that Tolkien set out in Lord of the Rings and still have it be recognizable as a D&D game? Could you run a typical D&D game and have that trend toward mundanity, or would it become something else entirely by the time you're done?
I don't think you'd have a problem running a D&D game that trended toward mundanity. I think you'd have problems running a D&D game that trended toward humility, where the defining central character was entrusted with the job because he was meek. That is just the antithesis of D&D. I bet you I could run it, but
it wouldn't be D&D.
It wouldn't have
anymore.
It wouldn't be able to go for very long because he couldn't level up, and it wouldn't be D&D more. The Tolkien heroes do level up in a way. They come back to the Shire and kick everyone out without a problem, but Lord of the Rings wouldn't be D&D.
Yeah, really, if you think about it, Merry and Pippin do. Sam and Frodo just stay Sam and Frodo.
Yeah.
Oh, I disagree with that. I mean, they have their character arc, and they grow as character. They both of them do.
They do.
Specifically Sam.
I was going to jump in on you with Sam.
Because honestly,
Sam grows his nuts. He marries Rosie. He becomes the mayor. Frodo is kind of wounded for life.
In subsequent rereadings of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, to me, I realize more and more that this book is really about the journey of Sam.
Oh, absolutely.
Much more so than the journey of Frodo.
When it splits up and they're in Mordor, the camera does not follow Frodo. It follows Sam.
I mean,
when Frodo rolls away, the story keeps going.
And
until Sam shuts his door.
And Sam is the one who never did succumb to the ring. He actually, as the ring bearer, the only thing that he wanted to do was to help Frodo.
Mm-hmm.
To help him in doing that. And that's all he did. I mean, you talk about the humility. That was there. Yeah. Sam's my favorite character.
And when you talk about the hero's journey, the hero gets the girl in the end. Who got the girl in the end? It was Sam.
Yep.
I can see that.
And, you're girl Frodo in Middle Earth.
Yeah.
No, there was Eowyn and Arwen and Goldwater. I was gonna say,
you've got the double hero journey there with
Aragorn.
Those, with Aragorn and Eowyn.
Yeah. Oh, there's,
I'm sorry, Aragorn.
There's
and
at least
and Aowyn.
Nine heroes
that was
journeys
nice,
that
to our first topic, hottest chick in Middle Earth from the movies.
Aowyn.
Yeah, I agree. It was Aowyn.
Yeah,
100%. I love Arwen because I love Liv Tyler, but
yeah, I'll give
Aowyn,
you Aowyn
hands down.
I don't know, man. Rosie's kind of bad.
Now, back to where, actually, I was surprised at how pretty she was she was popped in there. And my God, the Hobbit children, which were actually Peter Jackson's
Pat just likes
sons.
Hairy toes. That's all it really is.
Not so much. But yeah, I was really surprised. It was cool.
But you know what? Anyway. I wish she would have talked.
Rosie?
Yeah. She never speaks. She just smiles.
But you know what? Our last campaign, Chab is actually trying to do that. Take a D&D game and pull it down as close to mundane as possible, except for giant ants and things. He just wanted us to have no power against giant ants and creatures.
When you break D&D down into super low, then the caster supremacy raises even higher, which is another topic for tonight. But
even in that case, because we were using D&D, he couldn't get the feel.
We weren't using
D&D. No, we weren't.
I'm not sure what that was. Chad, it was a bastardization of something.
But because it was somehow loosely, kind of, almost based on D&D, by very nature, he couldn't get the feel he wanted. I mean, because it's not in D&D's nature for you to be common.
And certainly no trending. Like, yes, I think you could take a D&D campaign and go from high magic to mundane over the course of the campaign. But by God, I wouldn't want to play in it. As a player character, I'm like,
the climax of my wizard campaign.
I start off having a +5 Holy Avenger. At the end of it, you're going
to
have a copper sword that probably isn't sharp.
There are ways you can run a world where, I mean, we're doing that in Battletech, Lost Technology, a universe that has already absolutely seen its high point and is in decline and has been in decline for hundreds of years. You could import that to D&D. As long as you affix magic to something concrete enough that the world can be losing and not getting back. And it could be simple as scrolls.
I mean, I see what you're saying.
We lost the magic language 1,000 years ago. Some people still have the books. They're increasingly rare. It's increasingly difficult to find someone who can read them. You could do that.
I'll give you that. But at the same time, it's still more of like in your campaign, wherever you are, it's almost like you're at a fixed level, though. Because that can be the general. Yes. That can be the.
Oh, that totally screws the balance of D&D.
Like the centuries long.
If fighters don't have magic by level 3, they're in the dust. Yeah. I mean, they are in the dust
and
anyway by level 6.
You're playing a campaign where magic is extremely limited, and like the magical swords are not a dime a dozen like they are in typical D&D, but extremely rare, so it's finite. What you've got, if you break it, you're not probably going to get another one, but at least you have it for a period of time, and you might find some other things, and you're probably searching for these rare things. But
as long as you find some way to choke hold casters in a similar manner, I think that's conceivable.
One of these days, I want to play a game where magic swords are a dime a dozen, because I've never done that.
You're kind of
supposed
to. That's
true. You really haven't.
In three is that you're supposed to have the magic mart in the back of the DMG, and that characters gain wealth according to this geometric scale that is also back there, and they apply perfectly exactly what they need to optimize themselves, because it's in the book and they could buy it. I never run it that way.
I was going
to
say, I think
I give them the items through their adventures.
I've played games like that in one shots and they seem like they'd be a lot of fun. I haven't experienced the campaign of it and I would like to.
I think everybody else around the mics has. We've all played in high magic or high fantasy campaigns.
I am running a super high magic game right now, but it's not for the benefit of anyone but the wizards themselves. So magic conventional weapons are relatively rare. Armor that's enchanted is relatively rare. The martial classes are considered so below wizards in terms of power and potency that why?
Yeah, and
learn more magic.
I'm not in any fantasy games at all right now. We've got Battletech, I'm in a superhero game, and I'm in a Star Trek game. All sci-fi.
You know what's interesting about that, Wayne, is because you'll get a lot of people that rail against high fantasy. They say, oh my God, I'm so sick of all the magical weapons and everything. It's just no fun. It's not a challenge. And that's the thing. That's what it is. These people are so burnt out on it. They've had it. Now their new thing is to play in a low fantasy campaign where you're lucky if you come across a +1 sword or a masterwork sword. It's like, this is
making
awesome.
Masterwork sword, like I'll do that for a goblin game.
But yeah.
Not.
But the point, though, is that you get that way because you become jaded from playing in a high fantasy campaign. You haven't had that opportunity, and that needs to be rectified. And someone other than Chad is going to have to run you through a D&D campaign for you to experience that.
I will, at some point before we're all old and dead, run a Pathfinder game in person for this group. And Wayne, I'll give you magic.
I've done Pathfinder one-shots, and I absolutely love it. I know you're feeling on Pathfinder, and I know Johan's feeling on Pathfinder.
I have not played you Pathfinder. I would like to play Pathfinder, so we need to do that.
Johan, you like 3.5 and hate Pathfinder, or you hate them both?
I like 3.0.
Okay. It still surprised me that you liked 3.0, but intensely disliked Pathfinder.
I think they ruined a lot of the things that I actually enjoyed about 3.0. 3.5 was fine. 3.5 incorporated a lot of things that I house ruled into my own 3.0 campaign. And it also did a lot of things that I thought were really, really stupid. And it mixed them up in such a way that it made it almost impossible for me to play it because there were so many small rules changes that I couldn't keep up with them.
I see.
Pathfinder is the closest thing to fixing grappling rules that I've seen. The grappling still sucks everywhere, but Pathfinder is the best grapple rules I've seen.
They have an entirely overhauled combat maneuver system in Pathfinder, which I think is better than especially 3.0s, actually. I mean, God. Enlarge person, reduce person, grapple. Hope you roll a 20.
Oh, sure. You know, there were certain things in 3.0, 3.5 rules that you just had to have a gentleman's agreement between players and DM that I'm not going to do this, and you're not going to do this, and we're just going to pretend this option doesn't exist. That's how we played it.
I think we could have a huge 3.5 Pathfinder wank between you and I at some point, even on the mics, but I see this consuming this episode and leaving Wayne and Pat going like, So let's do that later.
Wayne, the one thing that you'll have to be aware of if you ever do get involved in a high fantasy D&D style campaign is that you have to suspend your disbelief of the economy.
Yes.
Because it will make no sense at all.
Although you're playing Battletech, so you're already good at doing that.
Okay, yeah, that's a valid point. You know, you're walking around tanks in a for robot this mech. That
okay, I'll
costs
the, mech.
The same as a city.
Yeah.
And that's the way high fantasy D&D games are. Your average 10th level D&D character is walking around with the wealth of a kingdom on his right hand.
Yes.
You know, I think and I know I've
personally more powerful than the army.
Yes. I know I've mentioned this on the forums, but I've always had a problem with mechs as a concept because they make no logical sense.
No, they make no
They're
sense.
They're not cost efficient.
No.
But having played Battletech, you know, the con games of it and then now the campaign, it came to the realization at one point that it doesn't matter that they don't make sense. It's just fun.
I tell myself two things. I say
I'm a superhero fan. Things don't have to make sense if they're fun.
In a campaign that stretches the galaxy, battle mechs have a strategic mobility advantage because they can load onto the spaceship, load right off, and load right back on again. That would be really hard to do and take multiple worlds that way with a massive conventional force. Number two, the feudal society of Battletech. It is so ingrained in the personal honor of the people who have all the money and power to be mech knights that everyone is one.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's
your knight
concept.
Think that's cohesive. I still think somebody probably in Lao would look at the frickin' spreadsheet and say, we're going to buy a million tanks and take over the inner sphere, but I can quiet that little voice. It's more fun.
You're right, Wayne. The important thing is it's not about making sense. It's that there's really nothing cooler than to strap yourself into a big giant robot and beat the crap out of everybody. And, oh, look, I just lost an arm. I didn't actually lose my human arm. It was my robot arm that can be replaced.
And you did lose an arm.
I did. I lost it. But more importantly, I lost the PPC that was on it.
Yes.
That's what hurt more than anything else.
Now the guy who took your arm off is on our team.
Yeah.
Along with pretty much his entire command structure. The tangled web we weave.
It has been crazy, yes. What we have lacked in this really is a lot of map combat in this game.
We are on a drought. We have not
got to get back into it.
Yes. Well, and even when we have map, we have not had a clear-cut mech-on-mech combat.
Yes, we haven't. And I'll tell you what, I'm concerned because the next missions that we're going to be going on are going to be, like Dan has said, the ante has been upped now, and they're going to be harder combats, and we really haven't cut our teeth on any really good map combats yet.
Mm.
And we've got a couple people that are inexperienced in mech on
map. Who the hell
are
you looking at, boy?
No, I'm not looking at you to say you are. There are two people that are very experienced. You and, John and Chad. I have a lesser extent of experience.
Wayne
has almost
that.
None, and Beth has even less than that. So
yeah, but you guys are amenable to pilots suggestions.
Yes, but we need more practice. So
yeah,
I'm a little concerned.
What I've been doing, we're not going to get a lot of that mech on mech combat. I took home one of Chad's box sets, the City Tech set, and Sarah and I have been playing it just as a miniatures game.
Oh, cool.
Without the role-playing aspects. That's we're just putting the minimal minis on the table.
Yeah.
I take my five out. She takes hers. It takes freaking forever, so we decide we don't want to do 5-on-5.
Oh, yeah. A single, one-on-one or 2-on-2 would be a good way to start just for some practice.
Because, you
learn quickly. Five-on-five battles take forever.
It made my day the first time we're doing this. She rolls the dice, shoots off one of my arms, and she's just squealing in happiness about how cool that was that she blasted an arm.
Exactly,
off.
It is. That's what makes a game so damn fun. You're blowing crap off.
The speed, intensity, and volume of the hope beats and fear beats, to borrow Robin Law's analysis of these things, in a BattleTech game is just freaking rapid. You really want to blow their arm off. You really don't want your arm to get blown off. And it's constantly, for hours, these wire rolls can be made.
Yeah.
It's really fun.
And it's also interesting that how quickly things can go bad. Like,
yes,
for me, I took one shot and lost that arm.
Yep.
And 30% of my offensive power was gone.
In the game, as run out of the second edition books, that can't one shot anything else on the field.
Yeah.
The odds are slim that you're going to go center torso, chance for critical, boxcars, engine, but
it can happen.
A machine gun can do it. A small laser can do it. Mm-hmm. You are never safe, which is something I think D&D is missing, because if you have 90 hit points, you are safe. Unless you take 50 and you take shock damage and you fail your fort save. Is that even in there anymore? I don't even know if that's in there anymore.
I don't think it is.
I don't recall having read Pathfinder that in last year. Oh, come on. You're trying to steer it back to this conversation. Pathfinder gave you Sorcerer's Bloodlines, and those are just so cool.
No, they're not.
Yes, they are.
Speaking of sorcery and swords and that ilk,
we have another topic to talk about.
We
Pat. Should.
We better. We've still got time to fill here. All right. Oh, let's just go back to talking about hot chicks. Okay. No, I'm sorry.
How about we just think about hot chicks?
I will think about hot chicks and listen to you guys.
We can analogize
you guys talk about this crap, whatever. Our main topic for tonight is one that, Johan, you definitely wanted to be here for. So that's why we're doing it tonight. See how smart we are?
That's downright amazing. Clever.
It's clever. It is clever. Caster Supremacy.
Yes. The hot chicks of the D&D world.
Wizard is Pam Anderson 1991. Monk is Pam Anderson 2011.
The theory craft around 3.5 and Pathfinder and how it has changed the role of your pure casters as opposed to what it was in previous, like the second edition.
The traditional hindrances that they placed on casters in pre-3.0 D&D have all been written out. The traditional bonuses they gave to pure fighters have all been either written out or given to everyone. Therefore, casters, as you start to get into the upper single digits and once you get into the double digits, it's just a runaway, are qualitatively better at D&D Pathfinder than the martial classes. This is my assertion.
My counter assertion is that is probably true, but only with the right player behind the character sheet.
I will agree to you that if someone is not playing a caster properly or inventively or well at all, they will suck, if that's your point.
That is essentially my point. Yeah. However, I would say that you can put the same player behind a fighter or a rogue or a monk, and they will be very effective.
They may be situationally effective in the exact moment that the fighter or the rogue, not even the monk, are designed for. If that player is behind the level 10 wizard, they will be effective at any challenge the Pathfinder D&D system is capable of concocting.
I don't think I agree.
You don't think you agree?
No,
what can't they do?
It's not a matter of what they can't do. It's a matter of what they can't do in the hands of a player who doesn't understand what they can do.
Which is
most players.
I'll grant you that. I'll grant
and
you
I
that
will
a
assert that
player
most
who sucks
players.
Sucks at being a wizard.
No, but my assertion is that most players suck at being wizards.
I'm not going to go that far.
I mean, this is my experience.
I've only played with perhaps 30 people in tabletop gaming in my entire life, but I have not met many who could drive a wizard just as poorly as they could drive a monk. Maybe you have, Joanne.
I have.
Okay.
And in fact, I would say that's the majority of people that I've met. They don't play casters well. And if you don't play a caster well, a non-caster will smack it every time.
That's true. If all they do is run into each other with their base attack bonuses and their hit points, obviously the caster is toast.
Or toss direct damage spells.
Even then, as the levels get high, the maximized extended enlarged scorching rays and become enough to cinder a martial class.
And once again, you're talking about a degree of inventiveness that a lot of players don't have.
What do you mean inventiveness?
You're talking about tossing three metamagic feats onto a spell.
We'll do one. We'll maximize the scorching ray.
All right, so you maximize the Scorching Ray.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. No, tick Sime 6. Yeah.
So it's 24 damage. You compare the 24 damage
You
to...
start adding extra levels of rays. You can do more than 46 with a ray if you have enough levels.
Well, okay, hold on just a second. Let's step back from this just a little bit. So now, Johan, you mentioned something that I want to try to explore this a little bit more. The concept of being able to play a caster well. In your thoughts, what does that mean? What does it take to play a caster well?
The ability to play a caster well is essentially the ability to know the right spell to cast in the right situation, which is something that requires a fairly decent understanding of the rule system. If you don't have a fairly detailed understanding of the rule system, you can't play a caster well, and you should play a fighter because you'll be better at it.
I think I could teach someone in 5 minutes enough of an understanding of the rule system as it applies to casters to play them very effectively. Wake up in the morning, take some divination spells to solve the puzzles, and take a load of save or suck spells otherwise. Throw them at characters until they're blind or stuck in webs and force cages. Win.
Now, has that always been that way, John, or is it just now in the...
It's definitely been that way, in my opinion, since the 3.0 and onward era.
Okay,
since 2000.
In
second edition, it was a different story. If you wanted to get to the highest levels, you had to be a human. Then you had to cast spells that advanced your age. They made you die because you're a human. Wizards needed 2,500 experience to level. Thieves need 1,200.
Now, if we're talking second edition, though, you have to realize that once you got to level 10, fighters, you needed more experience to level than wizards did. Wizards started leveling faster.
Did they? Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't remember that. I do believe it. But fighters got stuff that no one else could do in 2 in a way they don't in 3 onward. If you recall, fighters were really the only ones that could be lords of estates that could have the best followers.
Okay, the best
followers. Fighter leadership was really a thing back then, and now it's really not.
Okay, I'll grant you that. But at the same time, fighters come with a fairly broad array of feats that they can make use of, which, admittedly, I'm going to backtrack on my own point here. You have to understand the rule system to pick the right feats.
Yes, you do.
But,
and I submit to you that you need a much stronger understanding of the rules to pick good fighter feats than you do to pick good wizard spells.
But that's something that the guy next to you at the table can spend 1 minute out of his time to say, take that feat, it'll be good. And that covers you for the next four sessions. No, that covers you for the next four sessions until you level 2 more times.
I can't say looking at the two of them, it seems like a fighter would be easier.
It's because I don't think it would be.
Because you go and you hit stuff. That's all you have to know. Versus figuring out...
You need to know how to power attack. You need to know when to trip instead of hit. You need to know how cleave works. You need to know quite a bit to know how to be a good fighter. Or even an effective fighter. I could sit down a wizard and say, dude, take blindness. You have second level slots open. You have third ones. Get haste and webs. There are just so many spells that are save or suck. Or massive buffs to the rest of the party that... I don't think it's that hard to play a wizard that's incredibly powerful in Pathfinder.
Now,
and I think it is hard to play a fighter.
Another counterpoint to what you're saying that I'd like to point out is all of those save or suck spells still require you to have a fighter standing next to you. You cast blindness on the 10th level fighter over on the other side of the map. Okay, he's blind now. He'll still kick your wizard's ass unless you've got a fighter to go kick his ass.
The blind fighter might not be able to find you. I'm pretty sure a wizard would... with a blinded fighter 100 feet away can Scorching Ray his ass to death without too much of a sweat. Yes, lightning if you're right bolt, on the fighter, bolt. he gets a chance to whack you even though he's blind. You have total concealment. He's got a big chance to miss, but I'm making that guy roll some serious sensory checks to echolocate you unless he's like a werebat.
Actually, not a terribly difficult sensory check. It depends on the distance, but...
Well, you've also potentially got a feat.
There's actually rules for it.
Yeah.
I know there used to be the feat blind fighting, which I'm assuming
well,
still
exists. Well, if you're optimized for it, that's fine.
But
yeah, exactly.
So hopefully the guy to the left of you at the table told you that at fourth level. So
right. I fall more on Johan's side of it. I do believe that a fighter is easier to play just because it's so much easier to map out the feat trees that you're going to take, and that, which is one of the things I have hated about 3.0 and above, is that I feel that you're limited in the way you play your character because essentially you need to map out the feats that you're going to take before you take them.
Yeah.
Because if you make a mistake and don't take a prereq feat, you know, at level 5, then at level 20, sorry, you can't take the uber feat that you wanted because you didn't take that one.
Sorcerers are almost as bad.
And, you know, but that's what, and yeah, all the character classes away. I didn't like that because
sorcerers
I found myself.
Are to do right.
Wizards are much easier.
I use the term wizard very carefully. I think wizard is truly the class of D&D, and that sorcerers, clerics, and druids are just behind him.
I think that might be true now. my experience is a lot more with 3 than it is with Pathfinder.
Yeah. So, and mine is too, by sheer value of time.
And,
but my experience is becoming more with Pathfinder now.
And I will tell you that with 3, you can't beat a cleric. Assuming that this is played properly by somebody who knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
Clerics are better than everything, period.
I don't know enough about 3.0 and 3.5. I don't remember enough to be able to qualify whether I think they're truly unbeatable, but yes, they're absolutely a tier one class.
Yeah. I would say, like, at the very end of our only D&D game that wasn't really D&D, you know, we had Pad, who was either a wizard or a sorcerer or whatever. We had a cleric come in at the last minute, and her spell list, as she's casting these things that are all low-level spells, seemed ridiculously powerful compared to everything we'd seen in the game up to that
Clerics
point.
Clerics got a very healthy bump between 2 and 3, and as they've been incarnated since 3.0 came out, and Druid too, in my opinion.
Oh, and I know exactly why it happened too. And that was simply encouraging people to play the Band-Aid.
Yeah.
Because nobody wanted to play the cleric in second edition.
Yeah.
That's what you make the new guy do.
The best thing they ever did for the cleric, especially, is
spontaneous casting.
Yeah, dump a slot for a cure wounds of that level.
Yep.
That just makes them characters worth playing.
Yeah.
Yep.
Druids turning into gargantuan bears and then summoning more gargantuan bears on top of other things, and then the grapple rules come in and
anyway, back to the original point, I will admit to you that the most powerful character I have ever made was a caster.
Yes.
It was a cleric.
Okay.
I've never seen anything close. However, second and third were a rogue and a fighter, and I have yet to see anyone else's casters who could come close to that rogue and that fighter.
This could be an interesting challenge. This could be John and Johan go at it with level 10 wizards and fighters. I'm going to make it a will save against you naturally, but
Well, you know, the thing
that
is
doesn't prove
at
point.
That level in one-on-one combat, it's the initiative roll. Whoever wins initiative wins
the
combat.
Yeah, that's true,
too. And
that's
so it's true. Really not fair.
Yeah, that's not indication of their utility to a D&D group.
Right.
Well, so back to our original idea of this, that being the caster supremacy, which I think, if I follow this right, which I probably haven't, but that's okay. I'm the daddy today, so I say what it is, and you know, it's FTP. What I say is raw, for at least for this episode, that caster supremacy exists.
Yes.
How do we go about dealing with this in a campaign where you obviously don't have an entire party of casters?
You've
got the mundane, you've got the fighters and the rogues.
I'm running a Pathfinder campaign right now that is exactly an exploration of this question. I have said, in this world, this is an elven magocracy. People live for hundreds of years, and the casters are so much more powerful than the other classes that they have seized society and government. You have to play a specialist wizards because in this setting, the strains of magic are completely distinct from one another. There is no universalism, but you can either be a wizard or someone fighting for the scraps. And two of my PCs went for the wizard and one went for a fighter who is essentially their property. This is not a solution that everyone can apply to their game because this is a very weird and very particular style of game. But my solution in my current game is to just write a world that pure spellcasters have taken over. And the only serious competition they have comes in the form of the Wild Elf Rebels, who are, of course, commanded by druids.
Okay, but in your game, though, John, I guess what I'm not understanding is this one character that is the fighter, he's grossly underpowered?
No, he has exactly the same amount of experience points and levels and blah-zay-blah
right.
as the Conjurer and the Necromancer, but both in the context of the game world where they fall socially and politically, and according to my and pretty much all the rest of the characters' interpretations of what D&D characters are at 6th level, he is not as powerful as either of the well-optimized and well-played specialist.
Right,
wizards.
I think that's kind of what I'm trying. I think that's what the point I'm trying to get at is.
He is the guy who stands in front of them while they get charged by thugs, and he is the one who breaks their skulls after they get webbed or stinking cloud or whatever the hell.
Right.
But your question is what, Pat?
Because you've got this disparity in power, how do you fix that for the fighter character?
It becomes an element of the role play.
But is there anything you... I would say that one of the suggestions would be to try to modify the leveling between your supreme casters and the others or something like that.
Yeah, that's tough to do, but possible. You know, that was essentially the second edition answer. Give everyone 10,000 experience points and see where they fall.
Well, and there's two potential issues.
And you give a bunch of magic items.
If everybody is a caster except for one person, then one person could seem underpowered. If you have one caster versus everyone that's not, that's a completely different issue. Like in our last game, we had you being the one caster, Pat, although I would argue that at level 5, Dan was the more powerful character.
Oh, absolutely.
With his fighter. Yeah.
But I agree.
We saw what Chad would do is he knew your spell list and he would prepare counters.
Yeah.
You pull up a shield, here's dispel magic. You go mist form, here's wind to blow you out the window. Yeah. It was a passive aggressive attack against
him. Well, that's the value of a system that has nothing you can pin down and a narrative that goes nowhere but where you think of in the immediate moment. It's really easy to counter what the players can do. Yeah, there's nothing in the damn book.
You can easily turn a game of D&D into Rocket Tag.
Yeah.
No problem to do of both pull out your guns and your counter guns, and whoever gets off the first shot wins.
Yeah, and for some people, that could actually be a lot of fun. I wouldn't want to be in the middle of that against
the game. It's certainly appropriate for a Deadlands game or whatever the hell that's called. In a game with guns, it's great. In D&D, not so much.
It's all right for a session. Past that, it gets old really quick, in my experience.
Which is why I tend to run characters that are middle single digits in the levels at the highest, because that becomes much more common as you get into the double.
It does. I've taken two approaches to the problem that you posed. One is from a player standpoint, and one's from a GM standpoint. From the GM standpoint, what I've done in the past was, it was just flat out a gentleman's agreement. My players and I sat down and said, look, these are the spells that will ruin the game and make it not fun to play. Wow. Let's not use them.
Speaking of which, energy drain. Subject gains 2d4 negative levels.
That's not even one of the bad ones.
No.
What level is that?
That's 6.
Like ninth level. Yeah, for that, that's just terrible.
Yeah.
This book only goes up to level 9, so.
Well, the level 9 spells are like Wish and Miracle.
Right.
That awful for a level 9 spell.
Power Word Kill.
Mm-hmm.
Power Word Kill's not even that.
That's like a 7.
7, yeah.
And I believe that's a 3-0 book that you're sitting with there.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Just use Harm. Harm is the game killer.
Oh my god, that is a great spell.
I forget exactly what the mechanics of Harm are.
You roll a d4, that's how many hit points your target has left, no save.
Yeah. I mean, you go from 100 hit point fighter to 2.
You at least give that bastard a fortitude save.
Right. And obviously either an oversight of mechanics, because it's the reverse of a heal spell.
Yeah.
And so the heal spell had no save, therefore the reverse didn't.
Nah, that doesn't.
Or they left it that way for tradition, because in first edition, Harm didn't have a save. Yeah. So.
And actually,
they changed that in 3.5.
If they saw that as a heal through a mirror darkly, they screwed up, because you can roll a save against heal. That's not encouraged, but I'm pretty sure your character can opt.
I believe you can in 3.5. Not
you don't think
3-0.
You could in 3.0? Okay. You could be right. I do not remember, but I'm pretty sure in D&D PF, as I've played it in the last several years, they have noted at least here and there that optional saves to avoid buffs and heals.
That's one of the things they have fixed
I think that's a good thing.
Came out. That was my GM perspective. Okay. Was simply go through the spell list stupid and say, spells. We don't use stupid spells.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to use Power Word Kill, neither are you.
Mm-hmm.
Done. It worked fine. That reduced casters to much more on par with everyone else. In fact, a little underpowered for the most part in straight up combat.
Yeah, depending on how bad you pared back the tree, you could
and
severely
they were
gimp them.
Fantastic for utility purposes, but once combat rolled out, the fighters and rogues had their chance to shine.
Yep.
And so I think that worked well.
Rogues aren't a true gimp class, but that's another discussion.
As a player, my approach, actually playing a straight caster in the campaign I'm in right now, and the approach I've taken is to use spells that help the rest of the party, but don't obviously dominate it. And I admittedly had quite a few newish players in our group, so they didn't necessarily understand the mechanics of things all that well. So I could use fairly potent debuffs, and yet the fighter could still go run up and smash the guy I just tossed glitter dust on. And
glitter dust hurts.
The fighter goes, well, I just beat him. And they had their moment to shine, and I was just Poncy spellcaster who sit in the back and threw illusions and sparkly dust everywhere, and
the last
nobody
time
took me seriously. And yet, you know, I was definitely very powerful, very major influence on the battle, but not in such a way that the rest of the players felt that I was overwhelming their place.
The last time I played a sorcerer, I did much the same thing. I didn't do it on purpose so as not to overwhelm the other players. I play with very experienced players, but I happened to be in a party. It had a rogue and a monk, and while I think the monk is far and away the weakest class in D&D Pathfinder,
it is.
It's damn good to buff. If you're at level 2 and you've managed to mage armor and enlarge and haste a little bit later that monk, it actually looks pretty good. So what I would do was sit back and get those two in their thing, you know, flanking, the monk blocking everyone, and from there it would go to saber sucks. It wouldn't go straight to damage. I tried a character who was averse to killing things, but not averse to permanently debilitating them in order to serve a sufficiently good objective. So buffs and saber sucks are ways for everyone else to still feel like they're really doing
the work. My caster has a grand total of one spell that does damage, and the only reason he has it is because it's a bloodline spell, and I was stuck with it.
Yeah, I think mine might have too. I took the dragon bloodline spell, and I think there is a straight DD spell or two. I don't remember exactly, but yeah, and I never used it.
So those are my solutions, is just a deliberate stepping back, and as long as you're conscientious about it, it works fine, and it's easy to fix.
All right, well, let's take this from a different perspective. Let's spin it around and let's talk about from the other classes' perspectives. Mm-hmm. What can you do, or what can be done by, I don't know, the gaming systems to, instead of taking the caster supremacy down, bringing the fighter abilities, the fighters and the monks.
Lots of trapped boxes, lots of opportunities to track things through the wilderness. Situational challenges that demand the skills of another class.
Yeah.
And eventually when you get high enough, the wizard can solve all of those too. But at low levels, the wizard has a tough time with a locked box or the fact that orcs were here 3 days ago and it's just snowed.
Until he's had time to make a library of scrolls.
Yeah.
At that point, the wizard really can just dominate everything if he's being a bag.
Yes. So, well, it's not like knock is a broke ass spell, but it breaks rogues.
Does anybody have any ideas? I know this is a tall order question, but I'm thinking more along the lines of a game system changer. Is there any suggestions that you might have for helping those?
This is what I mean by this
I think 3.0 and on answer to that for fighters was the fighter maneuvers, the feats, I think was what they tried to do to say, okay, well, here's what we're going to give fighters to make them more powerful.
And bringing back barbarians, they had to make something about fighters that wasn't just hit points and armor class.
Right.
And so they came up with this feats and skills system.
Because they didn't want to give barbarians the original 1E weakness of must hate mages.
Yeah.
Because that was really, really
dumb.
That's
stupid as hell. And it still lingers on in some RPG settings. I think it's just dumb as hell.
You know, personally, I've always bothered by trying to bring the fighters up too much. I mean, the idea of magic to me, when you look through fantasy settings, the magic characters pretty much are just a lot more powerful. If you're within a game, if I can choose a bow and arrow or I can choose a magic bolt and they're going to do the same amount of damage, then what's the advantage to going magic? Well, why not just do the bow and arrow?
My answer to that from a perspective of most fantasy storytelling is that in most fantasy settings, the spellcasters have all been working on it for 40 years.
Yeah.
Yes.
And by extension into an RPG, they're 15th level versus that second level fighter who just came off his farm and has his daddy's sword.
Yep.
Of course, the 15th level spellcaster is better. That's how I've always portrayed it in my mind when converting that sort of thing into a gaming setting.
But Wayne, you hit on another issue, which runs with the issue that Pat brought up, and that is, can very high level legendary fighters do magical things? The classic example is, can a level 20th fighter cut through a wall of steel with his sword? It's physically impossible, but to give him a level of power that approaches parity with the wizards, you have to get into, he can jump 100 feet, he can punch through rock walls, and et cetera, et cetera. And some people, and I'm mixed on this, and you've articulated the position that's stupid, that makes them wizards. And I don't know.
And it's a good point, because just in looking at the other characters that are not playing, you know, the wizards or the sorcerers or whatever, if you are playing to high levels or even mid levels, but certainly once you get to level 20, you would have to think that, you know, your epic journey has gotten you somewhere that you're extremely powerful. And in their own rights, I think, you know, a fighter, they are powerful, but again, compared to like the caster classes, I think not so much so at all, because, you know, at level 20, wizards are pretty much like undead liches or whatever. They're just
walking gods. They can cast wish three times a day.
Yeah, they are.
And what can a barbarian do? He can get mad without getting tired.
Yeah. A fighter can fight all day, and that's it. He can have a lot of followers.
Yeah,
he's not
anyone can have followers.
He's not a living god.
Yeah, I mean,
most classes can have them better than fighters can.
Sure.
Because they have a higher charisma.
And so, to me, that's, I guess...
Bards have the best followers now.
Yeah, bards and sorcerers.
And maybe the answer is just simply...
You hate bards too, Johan?
Oh, God, I hate bards.
Wayne.
Maybe the answer is just simply that casters are the ultimate class. And that we don't need to worry about making it fair for everybody else, for every other class.
Pretty much what because it's I not think like D&D Pathfinder
everybody
has
you know it's the whole concept edition. Of that everybody gets a trophy and nobody wins the game. It's that's not what we're going for here. Throwing it out there. Yeah. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying maybe that though is just what we're getting
we
at
have
here,
forgotten to mention fourth edition solution, which is make everything function like spells.
Yeah,
make fighters have encounter powers and daily powers, which are fighter spells. And that's one way of doing it, but it's really bland and stupid, and we all know how well 4th edition sold. So
now,
we're going to shelve that one.
In that vein, I have seen that done well in my mind in one iteration in D&D, which was the Tomb of Battle.
Tomb of Battle, yep.
And I thought that was an excellent system.
It was.
I thought it was very flavorful. It really made fighting classes that were fun to play.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, they had a very spell-like system behind it. Kinda.
Yeah.
But it really didn't come off as here's your wizard, we're gonna call him a fighter.
Yeah.
And
no, I agree. Tome of Battle was very artful.
I don't know. There's a lot of talk about combat and the mechanics of it all. Really, I mean, for me, if we're telling a fantasy story, I have no problem with one character being the older wizard that is ridiculously more powerful than the others. I don't think you always need to have every character balanced. It's just depends on the type of game you're running. Mm-hmm. If your game is combat focused, then you're going to want to do a lot of balancing to make it fun for everyone. If your game is more focused on the story, then you may not need to do as much of that. I would be perfectly fine with a 15th level character playing with 7th level characters. You know that one guy is just the ridiculously powerful one.
How the hell do you make encounters for that?
Well, that's the thing. In the situations that I've actually seen that happen, it's been maybe that 15th level character is an NPC run by the GM. I certainly
and he better fall down the Balrog pit at some point or else the rest of the party is irrelevant.
I certainly wouldn't put that in the hands of a player character just for that very reason, because
you have to realize that in D&D, it is very, very possible that the 15th level wizard who, yes, he's good at casting spells and you think, oh, sure, he can dominate the combats, but he's also better at talking to people. He's better at detecting lies. He's better at
everything. He can control people's minds. Yeah. He can open all the lockboxes. He can find all the orcs.
Because what you're talking about is, because we're talking about playing a game. I think that all works out perfectly if you're telling a story. If you're trying to write a story, that's fantastic. Gandalf's a great character. He's one of the best. He's great for a book. I wouldn't want to be playing Gandalf
in my party.
Something I may have failed to articulate, but is a good point. Everyone gets good at something in D&D.
Mm-hmm.
Wizards get good at everything.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah, that is the fundamental flaw with the caster system in D&D. It's less of a problem with sorcerers.
Because they have to go very narrow.
Right. Mm-hmm. Any caster, it's worse in my mind with clerics and druids. Because they have every spell in the game.
Because at least they will never give wizards healing. Outside of very weak conjuration, like one hit
vampire
point around
touch.
Bullshit.
Oh, man.
Or vampire
touch. That's
hit
the
point
best
stealing.
Spell. I always
summon
have that.
Summon monster, sir.
Oh, yeah. Summon monster is awesome, but vampire
touch.
As
a best spell or as a healing spell?
As a healing spell.
How?
What? Summon a celestial. Heal.
Oh.
Thank you.
Oh.
Dismiss.
Okay. I've never done it that way. Just
summon monster.
I've never had it that high.
Is the worst, most broken thing in the game for somebody who really wants to get behind I want to destroy your game with my caster.
How high do you have to be able to summon a celestial?
What level
is that?
You start at like level 3. You can summon low level celestials, lanterns, archons and such.
Anything, and they can all heal. Cool.
Not all of them. I don't remember exactly how high up you have to get before the first thing that has healing powers, but it's surprisingly low level.
Wow. And summon monsters always good anyway before you get there.
Yeah,
you can summon spiders that can knock people out.
Or you can summon wolves that
can destroy everybody. Or they can flank everything and
just stand in the way.
Yeah.
Yep. Or summon 8 things with a 3rd level spell, summon 8 of the low level stuff, have them surround something and all aid the fighter's attack.
Yep.
Fighter does maximum power attack, thing dies.
Which makes one wonder, why not summon a 9th thing and tell the fighter he doesn't get a share of the treasure?
Well, yeah. Yeah, and that brings me back to, I think you're right.
Can't be a dick. Yeah, I agree with you.
Casters are overpowered, but only if you make them so.
Okay, that's fair. That's the official Facebook consensus.
Alrighty, well, I think that is going to do it for that topic. I think we've beaten that dead horse into the ground with our 9th level spells and our 7th level harm.
Tune in next week on Fear the Boot for John and Johan argue whether monks suck.
They do. Spoilers. Really? You don't get conventional diseases anymore? That's awesome.
You guys can just wait.
I have... blind.
You can just wait and play a monk in WoW and see what you think of it then. That's a whole
No. I'm not playing WoW. World of Kung Fu Panda.
That's right. Yes, exactly.
Everyone's going to make the DreamWorks face.
Oh, boy. What can you say about that? All right.
I realize you made the peon sad. Yes, I know.
I will end the show with a couple of announcements since I didn't do it up front because Dan didn't put it on the list. So I blame Dan. What else is new? Just a reminder that, again, the Fear of the Con site is up for Fear of the Con 5. So all you GMs go out there and register your games. All you players go out there and get signed up for games. Look for that sort of thing. The Riot and Room Share threads are up and going strong, I know. And I know that Chris has taken care of getting rooms blocked at the Jury Inn. So I believe that that is now ready for people to make reservations. And I believe that some people already have. So that is available as well. I think that does it for announcements. Have a good week gaming and we'll see you next time.
See ya.
Bye, everybody.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.